This is KPCW. It's 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, March 10th. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 37 degrees here in Old Town Park City. I've got a big cloud sitting over Old Town Park City, but we'll wait to hear what Cedric has to say. A few clouds in Heber City as well, currently 40 degrees. And on the phone with us is meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. Get ready for a little cooler weather moving in for us today. We'll call it a mixture of sun and clouds, but expect more clouds than sunshine as we go throughout today. Temperatures warming up into the upper 40s to near 50 in Park City. We'll see those highs in the upper 50s for us in the Heber Valley with partly cloudy to mostly cloudy skies. Tonight, cool air rolls in, so we see our temperatures dip down into the 20s for both the Heber Valley and the portions of the Park City area. High temperatures on your Wednesday will be cooler, with highs only in the mid-40s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 50s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your forecast for your Thursday, look for partly sunny skies out there. Temperatures starting off around the freezing mark. We'll see those highs climbing into the low to mid-50s in Park City. We'll see those highs warming into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. Once we get towards your Friday, look for plenty of sunshine. Temperatures kicking off in the mid-30s. We'll see those highs warming into the upper 50s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. Once we get to the weekend, the warming trend will continue with partly cloudy skies expected. We'll see those highs climbing into the upper 50s for us on our Saturday, highs in the mid-50s on your Sunday in Park City, with highs climbing into the low to mid-60s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into next week, we continue with the dry and warm thing, with a big ridge of high pressure settling in over the western half of the country. That means high temperatures nearing 60 in Park City, highs in the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. Overall, we're going to be looking at somewhat of a heat wave, potentially a significant heat wave across the western half of the country. That's just going to mean well above average temperatures expected for us in the near and long term, at least through late this month, along with pretty much dry conditions as the main storm track stays well to our north. There's a very slight chance of something popping up as we get into a couple of weeks from now, but between now and then, looks pretty dry. As a latest forecast for the Wasatch Back, I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us now from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning. So things are generally quiet in the backcountry. We had no new reported avalanches. Those ski resorts did report some small, wet, loose avalanches yesterday. Winds have been picking up quite a bit. We've seen gusts close to 60, 70 miles per hour above 11,000 feet. So the primary concern today is going to be wind-drifted snow. We've got a moderate danger at all upper elevation aspects and mid-elevation aspects facing northwest through north through east. The cool temps and the elevated winds are cool temps today, and the elevated winds should keep the wet snow at bay. But if the sun does come out this afternoon, we could see some more wet loose activity.
Okay, Nikki, thanks so much. Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott. We'll take a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. From KUER, government reporter Sean Higgins with a final update of this year's legislative session. And from the People's Health Clinic, pediatric specialist Dr. Jeff Schiff. Well, due to low snow in Bozeman, Montana, the University of Utah was asked to host the NCAA Ski Championships. They start today with the opening ceremony at the Utah Olympic Park at 4 o'clock. Then NCAA Skiing Championships themselves begin tomorrow and will finish on Saturday, March 14th. The Giant Slalom will be held on Wednesday. The 7.5-kilometer Nordic Classic will be held on Thursday, the slalom on Friday, and then the 20K freestyle on Saturday. All of the Alpine events will be held at the Utah Olympic Park, and all of the Nordic events will take place at Soldier Hollow. Well, a detective says a private investigator provided breakthrough information in the case of Eric Richin's death. Deputy Jamie Woody, previously a Summit County detective, testified Monday that the investigation into Eric Richin's death had all but stalled by the fall of 2022, months after his fatal overdose. That was until a private investigator hired by Eric Richin's family provided a break. Deputies ultimately arrested his wife, Corey Richin's, in May 2023. Todd Gabler says he was initially hired because the family was litigating property issues with Corey Richin's in civil court.
I was following the instructions of my client to turn over anything I thought was relevant to the criminal investigation. This is not my case. My case is in the civil court.
Corey Richens is charged with aggravated murder, attempted murder, and financial crime. She has pleaded not guilty. Gabler says he interviewed 40 to 50 people in his investigation. He also pulled Eric and Corey Richens' phone billing records. That led him to Corey Richens' housekeeper, Carmen Lauber, since the two allegedly exchanged hundreds of messages in the weeks before Eric Richens died. Summit County prosecutors now allege Lauber bought the fentanyl that Corey Richens would have used to poison him. During cross-examination on Monday, her defense attorney, Kathy Nestor, tried to portray Gabler as an extension of the Summit County Sheriff's Office who isn't bound by the same legal rules.
I'm not a state actor.
Right.
I've never been a state actor.
Right.
I will never be a state actor.
Right.
Yeah.
Not being bound by the same legal rules did allow Gabler to search the Richens family home numerous times after Corey was arrested. He alerted sheriff deputies when he found something they missed, and the deputies would secure a search warrant. He also placed GPS trackers on vehicles used by Corey Richens, her mother, and her brother. Gabler says that in these and other instances, he complied with Utah law and good ethics. A 2008 KSL report indicates he has employed tracking devices before, including placing one on the then Salt Lake County District's Attorney family car.
I don't need law enforcement to babysit me.
Okay.
Gabler testified that he tipped off deputies about a good time to interview Lauber because she was, quote, on the ropes in drug court. Prosecutors tried to emphasize that his and Summit County's investigations were independent of one another. Gabler did say when he would request information from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, such as the full 911 call, he says he was denied and added that police agencies are usually, quote, one-way streets. Gabler was expected to be the prosecution's second-to-last witness before Detective Jeff O'Driscoll. O'Driscoll took over from Woody as the lead investigator on the case in early 2023. The defense has its own witnesses and case still to present. Well, the Summit County Council meets tomorrow starting at 2:10 in work session. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, let's just start quickly with a budget question here. As we know, in the Corey Richens case, we have Summit County footing the bill for both the prosecution as well as the court-appointed defense attorneys. Any idea what we're up to in terms of money, dollars spent so far?
I don't off the top of my head. I do know that we have budgeted in both in 2025 and 2026 a significant amounts of money in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. This will definitely be I believe at least $1 million just in the defense side of this. And that, and you know, Margaret and her team are they're employed whether they're doing this or something else. So not only is it going to cost us a significant amount of money, we've had to bring in other attorneys just to prosecute the day-to-day cases. So the impacts of this are going to be far-reaching, and we hope that it will be a spike. It'll be something that will go down eventually, but we've had some major opportunity costs by having to fund this trial.
Yeah, so how do you fund it? I mean, you don't just have $1 million laying around in the budget.
We did. The emergency services sales tax was a major impact positively for that. We would have just had to go through truth and taxation. That's just flat out what we would have had to do. So we're hoping, while you can't spend emergency services sales tax funds on a trial like this, it can go to other things, other needs, and then that frees up funds for something like this. So this was a discussion part in 25 about this particular trial and it being an impact to us.
Yeah, I think Summit County is self-insured. Does insurance pay something like this?
No, I mean, it's a really strange thing because the counties are on the hook. If you saw a Utah County in the Charlie Kirk case, they're trying to ask the legislature to help fund that. We're watching that to see what happens there. It's obviously a very high-profile case, and it might get funding from the state legislature. But this is county responsibility, and it's really challenging, too, because we have to leave our legal team out of the day-to-day because they have, you know, they're on the prosecution side. We're working with the defense to pay their costs to address, you know, we want Ms. Richens to get a fair trial. And but it's really challenging because I'm not an attorney, and Jenny Young, who helps with this, isn't an attorney. So we're trying to make sure that we have the right costs, that we represent the taxpayer on what should and shouldn't be charged to us. But like I said, we're going to be well into the millions just on that one side alone.
Yeah. So the Kathy Nestor, the defense's lead attorney, she's hired by a contract. I mean, she's the she's outside of Summit County's
correct.
Legal team.
We do have a contract with her firm to represent Ms. Richens.
Okay. And is she the one that would do anyone that needed a court-appointed attorney?
Not necessarily. Mm. I think there were other options there. At the time when we chose them, we chose them because they had a lot of experience. They were interested, and we want Ms. Richens to have a fair trial. We don't want to do this again, first and foremost. So that's important. When I went into this talking to other attorneys, I was like, can't we get the bare bones, cheapest attorney possible? And they're like, well, I guess you could do that, but then you might be doing this trial all over again. That made a lot of sense to me. So as much as I hate paying top dollar, which is what I think we're doing, I'm hopeful that we just do this one time.
Okay. Let's move on to the state legislative session. It sounds like Summit County came out of this pretty much unscathed.
I would say that's true. We didn't love the 445 and that passing with the Morgan County, Summit County bill, even though everyone says we're not feuding. That's who ran that bill, and it felt like it was targeted at us. But and there's just a few others. But I think for the most part, we had some really nice wins with childcare. That was really exciting. And I think we just played some pretty good defense here and there where we needed to, and changed some bills. I didn't hear exactly where we landed on some election bills that were probably the most concerning to me and to our county. I think one was a little bit problematic, but we're still looking at those. And again, Friday, when the session ends, is a time to celebrate one way or the other.
Yeah, and I guess another one was the 1% restaurant tax left.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Now that House Bill 445, that was the property tax that Summit County now needs to pay Morgan County for the 910 Ranch.
That's correct. Unless you enter into an ILA or some sort of an agreement with the county, then you will be subject to those taxes. It doesn't take place for a few years, so we have a few years, but it will affect the 910 in that it was even property purchased before I think it goes into effect May, but even before that, there's property that will go into effect and 910 will be affected. But we're hoping to just enter into an ILA where we will have that agreement with Morgan County, whether that is paying taxes, isn't paying taxes, we'll have that negotiation.
Okay. Let's see. During the meeting, the council will be interviewing 5 applicants for 3 vacancies on the Summit County Housing Authority Board of Commissioners. All 3 board members are reapplying for their positions. So, I mean, what are you looking for here? I mean, backgrounds and what they can bring to the commission?
Yes, and I think the commission's doing good work, and it's really probably been a little bit of a slow roll to get them going. I think they're looking at ways, as we talk about Klein-Dolly or even Dakota Pacific, what's happening in the Kimball Junction area. I think the housing authority is trying to get involved. So I don't know what the council will do and any feedback they've received about the applicants, but they seem to be doing a great job. They have that monthly meeting during a meeting that I have, and I haven't been able to attend that, but we have 3 council members on that board. So I think we're very well tied into what that housing authority is doing, what they're capable of doing, and who those folks are. And I'm just excited that we had even the 3 that were on there have reapplied, because I think that's always a good sign.
Yeah. All right. County Council will also get an update on the Kimball Peak Center. You've decided now who's moving into that new building?
We're mostly there. As you know, this has kind of been a two-phase process, because when we first took over that building, we were in negotiations with the existing lessee, was Skull Candy, the organization, and they were wanting to take one floor, and we took one floor. So we started working on the bottom floor right away for the library and the DMV, and that is well into the tenant improvement process. I took a tour there with Janet Young, our deputy county manager, yesterday. It's been really fun to see that come to pass, and we've got if you look at the agenda packet, you can see what that's going to look like. It's just really, really exciting to see those walls start to go up. Meanwhile, as we were under that process, Skull Candy did find another location, so they have completely vacated the building. That's given us the opportunity to really dream about what level two can be. So this is kind of an update of where we are in that planning process. So the, what's happening on level one is independent of level two, but we're hoping to maybe maybe at the end do some a little bit of work on level two. It's mostly desks. It's mostly where people will be just working in an office setting, so it's kind of already set up for that. So we're hoping that wouldn't be a major financial impact to change some things. But if you look at that, the packet item, again, you can see what we planned for level two, and we've got departments from all over the county. We've got around 50 employees that could be up there that we're looking at moving. Lots of really exciting opportunities. We're often criticized as an organization of being very siloed. I think our geography is really challenging in that regard. We're in three different locations at least, sometimes more. So this is really an opportunity to bring all of the basin, and we've got, if you looked at the packet, we've got eight or nine different departments that will be coexisting together. It'll be mostly just staff, the public. It won't be open to the public. The second floor, of course, folks are welcome up there, but it's just going to be staff. It's going to be opportunity for collaboration, and really trying to break down those silos.
All right. I want to jump back to the first part, but on the second floor, there I noted on the diagrams, hoteling workstations. I mean, so what, people reserve a station? Is that how, what I, is that? I don't understand what that means.
That's a term that they've used for, I call them touchdown spaces. It's really actually, so my Jana Young will have her office in this building, but I will not. I will still be in the courthouse. So when I am in the basin, when I have an interview with you on KPCW, I could immediately go to this building and have a place to work. And I, right now I do that sometimes in the Richens building. There's very few spaces there. Sometimes I go to Quinn's where the health department is. That's they're busting out the seams. So it's really a nice opportunity for someone like me to be able to work there for a few hours. There's going to be Zoom rooms. There's going to be it's going to be really, I think, conducive to that kind of environment. So that's what those hotel spaces are, is it's touchdown spaces for any staff that needs a temporary location.
Okay, and then I also looked at the diagram, and I couldn't see the room, different rooms. They weren't marked DMV. I did see the library, but it all looks like it's library. I didn't see the DMV offices. I didn't see the auditorium that's supposed to...
So it should be on there. If you look at the first floor, the DMV is on the north kind of middle of the building. And I'm trying to remember that it's labeled. Maybe I'm looking at it through my own eyes where I know it's where it is. And it's, so we'll have to look at that and make sure we point that out during our presentation. But the DMV is in the north middle of the building, and then the council dais and council room is in the south east corner of the building. So right there, if you look out towards 224, and you can see the UOP there. It's those windows are really fantastic. So it'll be a really nice space, especially for a library, and people can really have a peaceful place to come and read books or study or do whatever they might do.
Okay, so that's what the contractor's doing, building those walls to differentiate those.
Correct.
What about the auditorium? I mean, is it going to be kind of a sloping auditorium where you actually can enjoy seeing a film or something like that?
It's not sloped. It can hold up to 250 individuals, and we do plan on having films in there because we had to address the windows and darkening the windows, and because there is such a great natural light space. So we have that kind of worked out, but it doesn't really slope. I believe it is just a flat surface. There, you can take that auditorium area, and you can kind of, we were going to have a way that you can close off the dais part, so you can have different meeting rooms, meeting spaces there. It could be just kind of, you know, a place for people to have a going away party for someone or something like that, and we'll allow the public to be able to use that as well.
Okay, and then the library, how much more room are they getting?
I couldn't tell you in square footage. I don't know off the top of my head. Between that and parking, I think we're very excited about the expansive space. It's also nice to be able to do this. Again, the Richens building has served us well for many years, but it really is so compartmentalized, and the way that you enter it and exit it, I think this will just be a really nice opportunity for library patrons.
Okay, and I think as part of the bonding for the project, you paying how much for the construction?
We bonded for the purchase of the building as well as the what we were calling the tenant improvements. I think we've got several million dollars in that, so I think maybe the estimates were a little heavy. So that's exciting. I think we bonded for almost $30 million, and I think between what we're doing now with the purchase of the building and then the tenant improvements, we're only about $25 million. So we might have other needs for that, but so far we're well under budget.
Okay. The regular meeting opening at 4 o'clock, the Utah Olympic Park Development Agreement back for discussion and possible approval. A number of amendments have been made over time. Critics have expressed concern about increased traffic, the effect on wildlife, and the lack of the use of the pool this summer. So have all of those concerns been ironed out at this point?
Depends on your definition of ironed out. I know they've been addressed. I know that the Colin and his team will come prepared to speak about those things. If you read the staff report, there was a kind of a memo from our legal team addressing the gate at Bear Hollow, the pool remaining open, and the legal team really said that that's kind of out of the purview of the council. That's up to debate. I think a lot of the residents would disagree with that, but I think that's something that it's if nothing else, I think we'd like to hear from the OP how have those things been addressed, and if the answer is we heard you and we're not going to do it differently, that's fine. Let's hear that answer. Or if it is like, well, we can do this differently, we can do that differently, I think that'll be helpful in making some progress here. It's in a full hour work session. We've kind of put this off for a couple of weeks as several of us, including UOP members, went to Italy. So I think we're anxious to hear this again and see what happens.
Okay. Anything else, Shane?
If you don't mind, I'd like to mention that we have our second of three 9-10 stakeholder meetings. That's today at 2:30 at the health department. So in Quinn's there. There's some time set aside for public comment, and it was very well attended the first round. And then we have the deadline to change your political party affiliation is April 1st, 2026. So you cannot change your party affiliation after April 1st. We do that a fair amount in Utah. Primary elections are on June 23rd, so I wanted to point that out. On April 1st is the deadline to change your party affiliation. You can go to our website for more information about that.
All right. Shane Scott, Summit County Manager, thanks so much for your time.
Leslie, thank you. Have a great day.
Well, the Utah State Legislature completed their 45-day session just before midnight last week, and on the phone with the final recap of this year's session is KUR government reporter Sean Higgins. Good morning, Sean. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, of the legislative sessions that you have covered, how does this one compare?
You know, we've talked a lot about this since Friday night, and this one really felt... We called it an admin day at the office. Nothing really exciting happened. There wasn't this big controversial push that really got people riled up. There were barely any rallies at the Capitol to protest bills. No, really none that I can think of compared to years past where we had, I'm thinking of the collective bargaining bill for public sector unions that got a record number of people involved in the political process. Certainly these high profile bills that targeted parts of the LGBTQ community got a lot of people up on Capitol Hill. And we really didn't have bills like that this year. There's some related bills around the edges that got people a little bit fired up, but really nothing that grabbed all of the air in the room and really focused everyone's attention. This really felt, we called it an admin session. We called it a meat and potatoes session. It was really, really business and getting down to the business of the state. So I don't want to call it boring because obviously these are really important laws that need to get passed every single year to make sure the state runs as good as it possibly can. But it was definitely on the much more mellow side compared to the last handful of years where I've been following it.
Mm. And that may just be the fact that there were a record number of bills filed that they just had to kind of keep the nose to the grindstone.
think that's certainly had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. I think when you look at the amount of bills that were introduced, we had over 1,000, I think around 1,000 in 19, 1,000 in 20. Less than, or around half of those ended up getting to the finish line. We had 540 who ended up getting to the finish line. So, and something that really stuck with me when speaking to leadership in both the House and the Senate was they recognized that there was this record number of bills coming through, but they said, we're trying to be more thoughtful, more deliberative with how we're doing business this year, and not everything's going to see it to the finish line. So even though there was this overwhelming number of bills that were introduced, a lot of them never saw the light of day. They were introduced, they were filed, there was maybe some drafting language, but they really didn't go anywhere. And I think a lot of that speaks to the fact that this is an election year. A lot of these lawmakers are probably being challenged in primaries, and they want to show their constituents that they're listening to them, that they're listening to their concerns, whatever they may be. And a good way to do that outside of actually passing a bill is to introduce a bill and, hey, I'm putting it in front of my colleagues and they're making the decision whether this is good to go forward or not, but I hear you, I'm drafting this bill for you. So I think that was really the factor there, was this election year. In really, I think next week is the first bits of election year with caucus night, but where it's hard to believe the 2026 midterms are already here. So I really think the number of bills introduced had to do with the election year, but the number of bills passed, I think, really reflected the priorities of this session. Affordability was far and away the buzzword leading into this session. And we mentioned that there were very few of these clickbaity bills that made it through, but there was a lot of other meaty stuff that happened that was a little less sexy, for lack of a better word. And it really spoke to this overarching specter of affordability that kind of clouded everything, with uncertainty in the economy. Obviously, the price of gas is something people are hyper-focused on right now with the violence in the Middle East. Housing is a perennial issue here, and there were some nibbles around the edges there. Certainly, I think a lot of people thought there should have been more done there, but I think a lot of what we saw this year of bills passed was because they really had other priorities this year.
Yeah. Well, the number one job of the state legislature, of course, is to pass a budget, which they did, a $31 billion budget, once more including a tax cut, about $101 million, a tax cut that, well, I mean, in my tax bracket, you know, it'll save me maybe a buck a week, even less. So this really only benefits those who make a lot of money, huh?
Yeah, I did a story on this a few weeks ago when they first were really getting excited about this tax cut idea. For the sixth year in a row, Utah has cut state income tax. And I posed this question to one of the lead economists at Zions Bank, who was a former state lawmaker, former chair of the Appropriations Committee. And he was very frank with me. He said, you know, tax cuts are largely for show when it comes to policy, because they're such small amounts. This year's income tax cut was 0.05%. It will be barely noticeable by many Utahns out there when they go to file their taxes. But it does indicate to constituents that they're thinking about these things too, and they are trying to do something about it. And I will say, taken year by year, they're very little cuts. But when you look at the last 6 years together, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but when you take to collectively how much they've cut the income tax over the last 6 years, that is not an insignificant amount that the state portion of the income tax has gone down. So I think there's a little bit of a two-edged sword here. 0.05% really isn't going to make a life-changing difference for Utahns out there, but it signals that lawmakers are thinking about this. They're thinking about how you and your family are navigating this tricky world of affordability in 2026. And when you look at the collective group of bills passed, not just this year, but in years past, dealing with taxes and affordability, it could make a decent dent in that tax bill every spring.
Okay, well, I'm guessing it's like a tank of gas, but yeah. All right. let's move on to education. Education, of course, has been higher education, I guess, has been hit in previous years. How did we fare with that?
You know, I think education is something that lawmakers have really been focused on in recent years. I think the exact number was a 4% increase to education funding this year, so just a little outpacing inflation. But they talk a big game on this one. And I think something I heard a lot at the Capitol was the starting salary for Utah public school teachers is the highest in the region. It's something they're very proud of. I know a lot of people may take issue with lawmakers touting all that they do for education when they look at the actual dollars and cents of it. Our weighted pupil unit is still lagging behind, according to a lot of people. But this is one where it really kind of depends on where you are sitting on the political spectrum, where you might look at the appropriations and say, hey, we need to do more for public education. And you might look at it from another perspective and say, you know, we're paying teachers, we're attracting more teachers to Utah than ever before. Public school is largely very popular in Utah, despite what some headlines might tell you, according to survey data. And it really comes down to that this was a tight budget year as well. Going into this session, we were expecting a very, very tight budget year. And we saw all these state agencies had to go through a cutting exercise where they had to come up with 5% cuts across the board just to see what they could do. That was eased a little bit in end of February when we got some updated revenue numbers that showed that the state would have quite a bit more revenue the rest of the fiscal year than they thought. So that eased some of those cuts. Some cuts didn't need to go as deep. Some cuts didn't need to go into effect at all. So I think that was something they were very pleasantly surprised with. And I think that reflected at least a little bit in some of the ways they looked at education this year. But I think there are certainly people out there who say that more needs to be done, not just with funding, but other areas as well.
And as you mentioned, again, several bills that we saw come and go with voting, it sounds like rather than trying to change things, we're just going to go ahead and pay for a study that will determine whether or not we have a secure vote by mail system.
Yeah, this was one of the storylines that I was particularly interested in, especially in the later half of the session. So you might remember that last year we had this big voting bill, HB 300, that really overhauled a lot of the way that vote by mail will work in the state, made it opt-in instead of automatic, added some other provisions to it. And then we had Representative Jefferson Burton, he's a Republican from Southern Utah County, have another bill this year that would have added more stipulations to that. A lot of the stuff that was originally proposed last year got taken out to get it passed. And originally proposed, this bill would have made it so you either had to, you couldn't mail your ballot in. You had to go physically to a drop box where it would be manned by a poll worker to physically check your ID. Or if you petitioned to have your ballot returned by the mail, you had to have a sworn affidavit attached to it with proof of ID. And this one was particularly interesting because the Lieutenant Governor's office earlier this year released this big report where they looked at voter data from the past several years, and particularly this issue of non-citizens voting. This is something that's taking up a lot of oxygen in the national conversation right now, and found zero instances. I think it's actually, no, zero or one. It was an infinitesimally small amount of instances of either voter fraud or non-citizens trying to cast a vote in Utah over the last however many number of elections. And I think it was over 2 million registered voters were examined and their voting records were gone through. And it just proved that this isn't really a problem in Utah. And yet lawmakers on the Republican side of the aisle, certain lawmakers, I should say, on the Republican side of the aisle are still really focused on this. And in this particular bill, HB 479, was making its way through the House passed through the House fairly comfortably. And then every single time we brought this up to the Senate, they were very wary of this. They would, the eventual floor sponsor in the Senate, Senator Michael McKell, who's another senator from Southern Utah County, same place as Representative Burton, really said he was uncomfortable with this bill for a number of reasons. A lot of senators who represented constituencies in rural Utah really didn't see a very practical application, how this would be applied, particularly for rural areas. It would be a burdensome, it would make voting a burden for people in rural Utah, whereas people in downtown Salt Lake City, where there are ballot drop boxes everywhere and polling places everywhere, it wouldn't be that much of an inconvenience, but it would be very hard for rural Utahns to do this. And this bill got stopped in its tracks as soon as it came to the Senate in the last week of the session and really didn't go anywhere. And what we got out of it was this election study to really have the Utah Valley University look at the pros and cons of mail-in voting versus in-person voting under the umbrella of a wider voter ID law. So we'll see this, how this pans out, and see the results of this in the next couple of years and see where policy goes from there.
Okay, I know those were two bills Summit County was watching. Another bill they were watching was House Bill 510. This was a Summit County representative, Representative Oxey's preliminary municipalities bill. It sounds like this didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, so this one, I'm looking at it, made it all the way up to the final day, and it looks like it only didn't pass because it didn't get a majority of votes in the Senate. There were too many senators absent. So I know this is something you folks in the Wasatch back are really focused on with a lot of the incorporation news happening back there. I think one thing that I really keyed in on this session was this push and pull between the state and cities and towns. I spoke with the leader of the Utah League of Cities and Towns about this exact issue, where cities and towns are very protective of the rights and responsibilities that the state has given them. And they are very covetous of a lot of those things, particularly around zoning. I know starting a new municipality is a big onerous process as well. But I think it really spoke to this push and pull that filtered through a lot of different issues between the powers of the state and the powers of the city and town across Utah.
Yeah, and then there was one other. I know that the county was watching Senate Bill 284, which would have provided some land use updates and water modifications. That too, just kind of stalling out.
Yeah, I mean, what it looks like, actually, I think I'm looking at this one right now. This one passed. But when it comes to land and water modifications, I spoke with the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, Brian Steed, earlier in the session just about kind of what we're looking at with water bills this year. And water this year was really focused on streamlining some of the process of how water rights work. I know it can be very complex and convoluted when land ownership changes hands, what happens to the water rights that are attached to those lands. And it was a lot about streamlining that process. So looking at this bill, right now, it was really focused on the way local land use and water is planned throughout the state. And I know that is something people are hyper focused on, because everything in Utah either flows to the Colorado River or flows to the Great Salt Lake, two bodies of water that are in dire need of more water. So people are hyper focused on what they can do to get get water that is not absolutely essential to be used by either agriculture, municipal use, or private residential uses, keeping it in the system and down to its final resting place in either the Colorado River or the Great Salt Lake. And this bill was just part of that larger suite of water and land use bills that was really focused on that.
Okay. Sean, anything else that kind of from this session that kind of stands out to you?
You know, I think the really big thing that stood out to me is what I spoke about at the beginning. This was a really down to business session. There was a lot of bills that, if they did move forward, would have gotten a lot of people very active at the Capitol. It made a lot of people really nervous going into the session. And I would give the legislature a lot of credit for the restraint they showed on a lot of these issues. I'm thinking immigration, certainly some LGBTQ bills really didn't go anywhere that would have instituted some pretty strict policies on certain members of that community. Certainly there were changes made to Utah's court system, but there could have been a lot more changes made to Utah's court system. And there really was a lot of restraint showed. And I think a lot of it had to go with this. There were other bigger problems that the state needed to deal with this year, with this tight budget year and this specter of affordability hanging over everyone in Utah.
Okay. Well, Sean, a big thank you to both you and Hugo for filling us in this session. You guys did a terrific job. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Leslie. We appreciate you.
That's Sean Higgins, again, a government reporter with KUER Radio in Salt Lake City. Well, Dr. Jeff Schiff is a volunteer pediatrician at People's Health Clinic. He joins me now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so start by just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in People's Health Clinic.
Leslie, I've been a pediatrician for my whole career. I'm sort of at the end of that, but the opportunity came up to when I moved to Park City about 7 years ago to be part of this caring and healing community that is People's Health Center. So I thought, well, this would be a great way to give back and to participate in this community, and it has been.
Yeah. So you serve what I think is like about one afternoon a week for the last 6 years. Doing what specifically?
Seeing kids for their health concerns. So general pediatrics, well visits, acute visits, some chronic disease that we see. So all of those things that we associate with going and seeing a general pediatrician.
And certainly ear infections.
Yeah, I've seen my share.
Certainly the clinic, you know, is designed for people without insurance, but specifically for children, we have a state program, CHIP, right? The Children's Insurance Program. Are these kids not eligible for that? Is that why they would come to the health clinic?
So Utah has a fairly large number of uninsured kids. The state CHIP program is really designed for kids who don't have access to Medicaid because of their citizenship status. And it's not a program that's big enough to take care of all the children in the state who are uninsured. So what happens then is we, as pediatricians and as the pediatric community across all of Utah, have decided to actually put those kids who need that the most into CHIP. So I had a kid, for example, who had seizures, who needed to see the neurologist. So that was a good kid to say, okay, let's go make sure that guy gets into CHIP, so we know that they get the care for complex illness they need. And then for some of the general things, we're totally able to take care of their primary care needs.
And I think about folks like yourself who decide to go into pediatrics, and I think it's probably very rewarding. I mean, kids are just fun to be around, right? Except for when they're sick, and that's got to be heartbreaking. I think even more difficult than dealing with, you know, a sick adult.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to work with a family and a kid, and not all the time, but very much for the most part, see them recover and become healthy again and be part of that journey with them and see the whole trajectory of their life ahead of them then. And it's been a gift to be in that situation.
Yeah. Looking at kind of your background, your work has included the use of policy and the implementation of quality improvement to improve equity and outcomes by fundamentally changing healthcare systems. So how does that happen?
So intertwined with my time at People's Health Center, I also have over the last 20 years been very involved in healthcare policy. I was the Medicaid medical director for the state of Minnesota, which has also been in the headlines recently. But there's a lot of work that can be done on the policy side to make sure that kids have adequate insurance coverage, that the quality of the care they receive is really top-notch, that the families are really involved in making decisions for their kids and that their care is coordinated. So we've been able to do some of those things. The state of Utah has some really great resources around working together as a pediatric community to improve care overall and improve quality. And I have had the pleasure and honor of doing some of that work nationally also.
And children, I mean, when you talk about kind of the chronic disease that you're seeing with children, is that just what, diabetes, or is it just the way kids are raised?
That's a great question. There are the most common chronic diseases kids have are things like asthma, allergies, and then the behavioral health issues about depression and anxiety and attention deficit and autism and all of those things combined. So those are a lot of the things that are on a pediatrician's plate in any given day. And then on top of that, the stresses that families are under impact kids. So financial stresses, stresses that can include the mental health of the parents as well, those things impact kids as well. And we see that, and we see that impact going from early childhood to teenage years and into adulthood. We can really see how that impacts kids. On the other side of that, we can see that resilience can be fostered as well.
People's Health Clinic CEO Mari Lining says that the clinic is evolving into a robust primary care and clinic-based specialty care model serving the uninsured residents of Summit and Wasatch County. So, I mean, what does that mean, evolving? I mean, isn't that something that has always been happening?
I would like to think that when I started, we were doing the best we could, and now we're trying to just do the best. We're moving from... for example, we now, this is not a pediatric thing, but we now screen patients with diabetes for retinopathy, one of the big cause of blindness. And we have the devices to do that, and we have the volunteer ophthalmologists to do follow-up, for example, where before we would have to refer that out. And if you refer someone out, they may or may not be able to get to the appointment. We have a wonderful relationship with the Intermountain Hospital here, where we can do all the labs we need to do. We don't have to parse out whether folks can afford them or not. And so that's a really important thing when we talk about screening and making sure our kids, we know where their health status is around things like obesity or diabetes risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so tell me, how many children does the clinic see?
We see right now 600 unique individuals, but we see many, many more patients with visits. So that's a few thousand visits at least. And the pediatric part of Peoples is smaller right now. It's about I'd say about a tenth of the total 21,000 visits that are seen at the clinic. But part of that has been due to capacity. And one of the things that we're really excited about here is to move from an all-volunteer pediatric department to a pediatric department where we'll have a paid physician that's aligned with primary children's.
Oh, so similar to what you have with Women's Health and Tanya Bodnar?
Yes.
Okay, and so that would be kind of a part-time position then?
Yeah, a part-time position. All of us who are volunteers love what we do, but we're not ready to sign on for 3 days a week or 4 days a week, so we're really excited to have the opportunity to work with somebody and then also align ourselves more closely with the work that's being done at primary at Intermountain and with the pediatric department at the university.
So the current wait time, I understand, to see a pediatrician at the clinic is like 8 weeks, so that's... in a life or death situation, cut it. Yeah,
we have a way to get kids who are sick in sooner, mm-hmm. but it's also, but when it comes to making an appointment, we want to cut that time down. Nobody wants to wait that long to see somebody for a chronic problem or even for a well visit.
Yeah, and that's usually what that wait is for those more intense, longer visits. Yeah. And you kind of mentioned earlier about the how children kind of react to what's happening in the family. I mean, I think that's interesting that children can kind of feed on the fact that parents are having a maybe a difficult time, maybe substance abuse or something happening, or even financial challenges. That's something that kids can pick up being that young, huh?
Yeah, inherently it makes logical sense, but because we're, you know, geeks, we want to make sure we understand that. And there's lots of studies now that have shown that if you look at those risk factors for kids and then see how they do, the more of those risk factors those kids have, the more it impacts their health downstream. So it's really, it's both important for how we view ourselves as a society to take care of those kids early on, and it's also important if you think about chronic disease in adults.
Yeah. Okay, I am about out of time. You got a final message you want to say?
I just think that I'm a pediatrician, so I have to say that how we take care of our kids is really an important reflection on how our society acts. And we have, at Peoples, we have this great opportunity to serve kids really well, and this community has a great tradition of that by supporting people. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Dr. Jeff Schiff, thanks for being here.